Bird Language, Beating the Concentric Rings of Nature, with John Young.
Okay, well, what happens when you're walking out in the woods, you decide to jog, and you've been working so hard and trying so hard not to disturb the birds around you. You've been really good practicing your routine of invisibility, and you're thinking, geez, you know, I got to slow down even more, and you're trying to go slower and slower, but you realize you're late for something, so you decide to jog from there to get home. And while you're jogging, you almost step on a fox, and you cause three deer that are feeding to explode out from in front of you and go dancing off in all directions. And you start to wonder, now, was that an accident? How come jogging, you seem to see more than when you're walking along slowly? It seems that jogging, for some reason, doesn't create the same impact on the bird language that walking does. I think it has something to do with the fact that your attention is on moving quickly. You seem to have less of a presence. So I have noticed that jogging or running through the woods, I end up seeing more things than when I'm walking really slow. It might be, too, that you catch things off guard, you get ahead of the bird alarms, or by the time the bird notices you're there, you're already past, so it doesn't bother giving the alarm quite to the same intensity. But I have noticed that, for sure. Both jogging as well as mountain biking, you seem to see more of the large wildlife than when you're walking. That's one thing I've noticed that you might also notice out there. The other thing is horseback riding. When you're riding horseback, you have a lot more close encounters with wildlife than when you're on foot. And I believe that's because the horse is perceived as the primary animal, not you, on the horse's back. And so the animals seem to have more respect for horses. I've gotten pretty close to animals on horseback as well. So those are two things you might notice that help you with your invisibility, jogging and riding on horses. Try jogging while riding on horseback, see if that has a more profound impact. The other thing is, I did want to mention miscellaneous things that don't seem to fit in anywhere else right now. One of them being other alarm call makers that aren't birds and ways in which that these things work. One of them being chipmunks. If you live, especially in the east, you'll notice the eastern chipmunk, which most people think is a bird when they're first out there, is a very intense alarm creature. It definitely is a very helpful thing to get to know the sound of the chipmunk. When you get real close to them, they make a sort of a chip, 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 and they run down their hole. But as an alarm approaches, you'll hear them going chip, and then they get a little bit faster. Chip, 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 chip. When the alarm gets real close, chip, 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 chip. And as the alarm goes away, they slow back down again. So chipmunks are kind of neat that way. If you startle a groundhog, otherwise known as a woodchuck, and in some places known as a subterranean whistle pig, you will notice that they literally whistle. And you don't often hear it, but you might scare a groundhog someday, catch it off guard, and it will make this high-pitched whistle as it dives down its hole. That's another alarm that you should get to know, the whistle alarm of a groundhog, of a marmot, and also a pika at high elevations in rocky country. You'll notice pikas do the same thing. Nobody needs to be told about the alarms of the red squirrel or the gray squirrel or the chicory. Squirrels seem to be the bane of every stalker's existence, and squirrels are incessantly noisy. When they decide to give an alarm, they'll just alarm and alarm and alarm and yell at you and yell at you and yell at you. Fortunately, they do so much yelling that it seems that the animals after a while start to ignore them, so they kind of seem to have the boy that cried wolf effect. But I will tell you that it is possible to learn to overcome squirrel alarms. It's not easy, but it's possible. And once you get in the squirrel club, that is, once you've passed what I call the rite of passage of red squirrel, once you've gotten into that club, they stop alarming at you no matter where you go. And the second Kamana independent study naturalist graduate, Dave Franklin, has a wonderful story in his secret spot experience over the year of how he had experienced this whole squirrel thing. It's really a good story about how in the beginning, how much the squirrels really drove him nuts because they were always alarming and telling everybody in the woods that he was there. And the more he went, the more he couldn't stand the squirrels, and the more he couldn't stand them, the more they alarmed. And eventually he kind of hit that point of thanksgiving, I guess we'll call it approaching nirvana, that where he actually had a breakthrough with the squirrels, and he learned to appreciate them and see them as part of the greater whole. And as a result of his shift in attitude towards the squirrel, he noticed the squirrels at a secret spot didn't alarm at him anymore. And he was accepted by them. It was just that one thing. It was a mental choice that he made to think differently about them, to appreciate them, to use that Thanksgiving thing. And all of a sudden, the squirrels began to honor him and respect him in the same way that he honored and respected them. So you might call them an alarm of disappreciation. He noticed something really unusual, kind of took him by surprise, and that was that not only did the squirrels at his own secret spot stop alarming at him, but he noticed that no matter where he went, he was accepted by the squirrels. So that's good news. Bad news is you got to work on it yourself. No pill. Again, I can't give you a magic squirrel pill, although we are working on it. John Gallagher's got that also under production right now. Deer, they also make alarms. They snort, and they also stomp their feet. Crickets, while they don't actually give an alarm, the sudden cessation of crickets is a sign that something is happening around you. The same with frogs. Frogs, especially green frogs, when you scare them at the last second, they make this little high-pitched chirping sound as they jump into the water. If you train your ear to that, you'll notice that the mink that's sneaking away from you might be scaring frogs into the water as it's creeping away. Ducks exploding suddenly off a wetland or off a pond, that doesn't happen randomly. If they're choosing to fly off because it's their choice to move locations, they don't do it in an explosive manner. That holds true also for grouse and pheasant and quail. They all have a very explosive sort of defense mechanism that if they have this loud explosive flight, that disorients the predator long enough for them to get away. So they will also choose a more quiet approach when they take off because it's their own choice. So if you hear them exploding out of a thicket, it's probably because something has alarmed them. Killdeer are excellent that way, as are other shore birds. They're very, very vocal. They make a lot of noise when they're scared up from a sandbar or from a gravel bar. And I can tell a story of how silence is often one of the best alarms. I told you already that the sensation of song and the stillness of a towhee is an alarm, but also sometimes hearing no noise is definitely an alarm, and you have to learn to really pay attention to hear these kinds of things. But I remember the night that a black bear stalked around me while I was sitting by a fire with a group of people, and we noticed the black bear stalking by, not because of the sound that it made, but because as it was passing by, it passed a little sort of trickling rivulet that was coming down off the side of a hill. And when the bear got between me and that rivulet, I couldn't hear the rivulet anymore. And then I noticed that the crickets that were really loud and audible in this one patch of woods suddenly became muffled as the bear passed between me and them. So everywhere the bear went, he absorbed the sound around him. And that was kind of a neat experience. That was a night when we recognized the black bear passing us by, which we later verified by actually seeing it in the shadows and then picking up its tracks and the trail that it followed. So another evening I was sitting down in the Pine Barrens at sunset. My friend had got his Jeep stuck, but good, in a mud puddle. And he had a hike out several miles, probably 10 miles, 15 miles, to the place where he could make a phone call to get his friend to come and pull him out of the mud puddle, because he was hopelessly stuck. So I was left alone there, back in the Pine Barrens a good ways. And I built a little fire and was sitting there watching the day turn to night. And all the summer insect sounds were really coming up around me, and it's a kind of a beautiful night, a lot of beautiful sounds around me. And as I sat there and listened, I noticed that the insects and crickets were stopping in certain places around me, and I could actually detect the movement of some animals. They came towards me and they split and went around either side of me. So on either side of the clearing, there was these patches of silence where the stalking animals actually silenced the insects as they moved along. It wasn't that they were muffling the sounds, they were literally stopping the insects. They were disturbing them. So I was hearing this little patch of silence move around me, and it was slowly, you know, starting up again, but the patch was moving distinctly on both sides of me at the same time. So there was animals that had approached me, saw me, and split up and went around me by going through the thicket. So I listened for a little while real closely, and then as they got closer together, they kind of growled at each other, and I recognized the voice of the wild dogs. And that night, they decided not to bother me. They decided to sneak around me. But once I realized that I was being stalked anyway, I took precautions. I had a burning oak branch ready, and I was also plotting my route to the Jeep if I had a run to escape. But when my friend Mark finally returned, and we got his Jeep out, we used the headlights of his truck to track the dogs, and there was about seven of them. They had been traveling down the sand road, got to where I was. You could see where they paused and looked and kind of figured out what they were going to do, and they split into two groups and went around me and then rejoined on the other side of me and continued on their way. So that was how silence acted as an alarm call for me. So let's journey now into the realm of bird language over time. You know, what's going to happen? Again, this is sort of another profiling tool that you guys can use to measure your own progress in your study of bird language. So we'll talk about the obvious stuff first. When you first go to your secret spot, the very first time you get there, I think you begin to bond on what you hear on that first day, and you think to yourself, well, gee, this is the way the birds must always be. But the one thing to know is that birds are constantly changing through the day, through the year, even through their lifestyle. Birds have different routines and different needs as the time of day changes, as the time of season changes, and you do too. I think you'll sort of see yourself reflected in this story, but let's talk about birds through a 24-hour period. We'll make some generalizations here. And remember, all these generalizations are subject to change as soon as you depend on them. That's how it is. The first sound you might hear, especially if you're from the east, before the dawn, that is, before first light, or as first light is beginning to break, you'll hear the voice of the mockingbird. The mockingbird will give what I call the pre-dawn call. It's almost as if the mockingbird is awakening all the other birds. You know, it gives a ch-ch-ch sound in the darkness of pre-dawn. Then starts the dawn chorus. And the dawn chorus is a very powerful experience. I'm amazed at the number of adults who have never really experienced the dawn chorus in a high-quality way. I'm sure a lot of us have woken up to the sound of birds singing, rolled over and gone back to sleep. Or maybe when we're camping, we hear them for a little bit, we tune into them, and then we go back to sleep. But to make people actually sit in silent meditation in the darkness of pre-dawn, to beat the mockingbird to the first call, and to have them sit there and listen to the birds wake up and watch the night turn to day, they've always come back to me and said to me that was one of the most rewarding experiences of their life. And they always pledge to do more of it. And I know the dawn chorus has a very special power over me, too. It's something to experience. And, you know, you should really make it a point. I know that Gilbert Walking Bull has talked a lot about the power of dawn, that time of night turning to day, as being a very special time spiritually for a human being. They have a special respect for it, you know, and it's related, again, to that knowledge of mankind thing that I will talk about again later on. I want you to know, too, that the dawn chorus is sort of an anomaly in bird awareness. You think about birds singing. Question that was asked to me is the dawn chorus a time when the birds are reiterating their territoriality? It doesn't seem to be. They all seem to be kind of singing and not really paying any attention at all to each other during the dawn chorus. They're all singing for the sake of singing. That's what it really seems like. Somebody noticed that the dawn chorus seems to move across the landscape almost like a front or a wave, and it really does. I think if we were in a hot air balloon observing the landscape below us, you would notice that the dawn chorus is moving from east to west as the birds are awakening, following the front of dawn across the landscape. So it really literally does come from the east. It's kind of a neat thought. But if you're in a place where you have a good view of a broad landscape in front of you, and you have the opportunity to listen to the birds wake up, you will notice them waking up really far off in the east and that they're starting to move towards you as they awaken, which I think is a really fascinating experience. And and it just keeps going around the world. Yeah, if you think about it, the dawn chorus is a front that continually moves around the world and never stops. So what's going on with the dawn chorus? I just want to give you an example of why I think it's a breach in bird awareness, and it's probably why things like foxes and coyotes and wolves like to hunt at dawn, because it is a time when bird alarms don't actually work against them for some reason. I once watched a sharp-shinned hawk come flying in the pre-dawn and nail a varied thrush right in front of me and another instructor, and brought that varied thrush right down to the ground, right in front of us. It knocked it right off the branch while it was singing during the dawn chorus. There was a puff of feathers, there was a dramatic struggle, and they both came down to the ground right in front of us, almost at our feet. And we noticed that none of the other birds paid any attention at all. They didn't even interrupt their singing. It was like that never happened. For some reason, during the dawn chorus, it's okay for things to hunt and kill things. You know, it's like everyone's obsessed with the song, and that's all that seems to matter. So the dawn chorus is in kind of a neat time in that way, because it's the one point where the birds don't quite seem to be yet totally on their awareness game. It is a time, the dawn chorus, it is a powerful thing, so much so that I once heard a hermit thrush singing its beautiful dawn spring song in the middle of February when it was -2 in the Pine Barrens. It was the first light, that usual time when they start singing, and here it was in the middle of the Pine Barrens in the stillness of a really, really cold, silent winter morning. I hear the hermit thrush's song coming across the darkness of pre-dawn, and it just made me realize that there's something powerful even to the birds themselves. You know, why would a hermit thrush choose to sing its spring song in the middle of winter like that? It was really a neat experience. Then, right after the dawn chorus, the birds seem to wake up, and they go about what I call the morning bustle. That is when they're all busy feeding. They're busy doing their thing, and they're singing still, but singing kind of slackens a little bit as they get busy feeding, because it's like they've slept all night. It's time for breakfast. During the morning bustle, there's a lot of alarm activity going on. There's a lot of territorial stuff happening, especially in the spring, and that's a good time to really tune into bird alarms. Then what I call the late morning hush comes over. It's about the same time in corporate America where everyone heads for the coffee machine, say about 9:30, 10 a.m. There seems to be a falling off of the energy of the birds, and they do tend to silence at that point. If you're a bird alarm practitioner, you're going out there trying to learn bird language, and you go out at the late morning hush, you'll begin to think that you're causing that silence. But it's not you. It's just that time of day. Everything seems to quiet down. And that late morning hush kind of feeds into the midday haze, especially in summer when there's just the buzzing of insects. And during that time of day when it's hot and it's really quiet, you hear certain birds that seem to almost sing that feeling, like the field sparrow, like in the intensity of the heat of the day. You'll hear the beautiful voice of the field sparrow, or the meadowlark, or the prairie warbler in the Pine Barrens, the same thing. And you'll hear towhees scratching and giving an occasional song during that heat of the day. But it is a time of day, especially in the summer, that belongs to the crickets and the cicadas. Ingwe talks a lot about that heat of the day in the equatorial sun of Kenya, and that during that high noon hour, say between 11 and 2 p.m., there is absolutely no sound at all out there because it's so hot that everything has to shut down and go into the shade. Everything, even the insects. And he says that that's always broken by the very forlorn and lonely sound of the emerald spotted wood dove, that always says the heat of the day is over, and it's almost like the new day is beginning, a new part of the day. We have something going like that too in North America, but watch for those. You'll start to notice those patterns. So what comes after the midday haze is the late afternoon wake-up. At that point, alarm behavior will start to become useful to you again, because in that golden light of afternoon, the birds are moving again, they're feeding, they're preparing for bedtime, and also that's the time when the foxes and the deer start to move again. You know, late in the late afternoon, that's when black bears are known to wake up and start to move about also. It's long before the sun goes down. But it's that time of day when the light turns golden. That's a very, very productive time to learn bird language. They begin to sing again a lot at that time. And sometimes the song will last well into dark. Like I noticed that certain thrushes like to sing beyond sunset, you know, into the darkness. Same with robins. There's that sunset flurry, the pre-bedtime behavior. There's a lot of insect-eating birds feeding at that time. There seems to be a lot of hatches going on at that time of day, a lot of insect activity, and a lot of the birds that eat insects, especially on the wing, are really active then, the flycatchers and warblers, as well as cedar waxwings. You'll notice the song is really starting to pick up right at sunset also. And at that time, you might see birds like nighthawks making their move to start their evening flights. And you'll notice at that time, the roosting bird flights, that is, birds that all gang together and sleep at night together, are all flocking up and flying over. You'll see big flights of ducks and geese and doves and blackbirds as they all head off to their roosting places. In the winter, you'll see robins doing the same. You'll see cedar waxwings gathering in little groups. They're real active at that time, too, getting ready to roost together, it seems. Then comes sunset. And in the grayness of sunset, you'll start to hear, just beyond sunset, you'll hear robins fighting with each other. You'll hear white-throated sparrows clamoring and scuffling in their roosts. And so we call those the roosting calls, the roosting behavior. So that's happening just after the sun sets. And then as darkness approaches, you might hear that ch sound again of the mockingbird. After the sun has set and it's almost like the last light of day is left, that's when that mockingbird gives that same call that it gives at dawn. And that's the last you'll hear. And then it's night. And of course, at that time, that's when the whippoorwills will kick up and the frog choruses will get really going. And it's the frog choruses at night that might be interrupted by the passing of a jet or the rumbling of a train or your footfalls or the footfalls of the night hunters that are moving in and among them, like the spring peepers when they're all singing this, the tree frogs. You'll hear their choruses be temporarily interrupted as a raccoon passes by. And then Tom always told stories of the one whose name I can't mention, who has such a powerful presence in the forest, the legend of the forest stalker that moves around with such power that he could stop the dawn chorus or he could stop the frogs from singing at night because his power is so awesome. I heard a lot of stories around fires that kept me paying attention, especially to when the frogs would silence. At night, you might walk through the forest and hear a mockingbird sing all night. Mockingbirds don't typically sing all night. I mean, not every night, but it's not unusual to hear a mockingbird singing all through the night. You might hear, if you live in the Pacific Northwest, the call of the Pacific Slope Flycatcher all night long, punctuating the night, the silence of the night. For some reason, it seems to be calling out in its sleep. And birds do dream. You'll sometimes be out at your secret spot at night and hear birds kind of sort of mumble singing in their sleep. You can actually hear them sort of partially singing. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but maybe you've been walking through the woods at night and scared a dove off its roost, or scared 10 or 12 doves out of a roost and just about had a heart attack yourself. Grouse will do the same thing. You'll scare a grouse out of its night roost, or sparrows in a thicket. If you walk by evergreen trees, you might scare a bunch of sparrows out of their night roost. In the wintertime, you have to be aware that if you move around a lot, you might scare a bird off its roost and end up killing it because they have enough heat and energy stored up in their feathers to last only one night. And this is especially true of things like chickadees. So if you should disturb a bird from its night roost in the middle of a very cold winter, you could actually cause it to die. So in the morning, you might walk around after scaring them out of their thicket at night and find their little frozen bodies on the snow, because they only had enough energy to keep themselves warm for one night and no more. So, of course, the night also belongs to the owls who are singing at night. That's their idea. I know it doesn't sound like singing, but that's what they're doing. Barn owls with their ghostly hisses and shrieks. Barred owls with their who cooks for you call, which you hear through the night in the wintertime or the autumn. You also hear the great horned owls calling. And then there's the summer. I've heard so many times people come to me saying that they heard a woman screaming, which turned out to be a screech owl. And there's other owls at night, and I've also heard night herons that have a very unusual call that have caused me to wonder what in the heck is making that noise at night. I knew it was birds, and I knew they were in trees, but I couldn't tell what they were. It took me a while to figure out they were night herons. And then there's the all-menacing sound of raccoons fighting at night, which people interpret to be the Jersey Devil itself. You know, this must be the sound of the Jersey Devil because it's so intense and so frightening when you hear it for the first time. So those are sounds through the day and night and as the patterns change. Let's look at bird language through the seasons. We'll start with the early spring, the later winter. the time of the year when the woodcocks in the east have gathered by the edge of the forest to go into their nightly displays, their dramatic flight routines. That's also the time for the early nesters. There's certain birds that get the jump on things, like great horned owls, who end up building nests and raising young while there's still snow on the ground. And the reason they're doing that is because by the time their young are ready to fledge, leave the nest, when the young owlets become hungry teenagers, the owls really need to have a lot of food around. And so they time it so that right when their young are fledging and the hungriest, that's when all the birds and migrants start to come back, and that's when the chipmunks come out of hibernation and that sort of thing. So hawks also do that. Red-tailed hawks are nesting pretty early as well. Winter wrens are nesting early, and robins have been known to nest pretty early too. So you'll notice that, you know, depending on where you live, that late winter, early springtime, you'll see the territorial behavior and song and nesting behavior in certain species and yet not others. That's not unusual. The territorial imperative really begins to kick in late winter, early spring. That is, the birds become much more anchored to a territory as nesting season approaches. They're much more defensive and territorial at the beginning of the spring than they are at the end of the spring. There's two reasons for that, and I'll come back to that later. We noticed that in the wintertime out here in the Pacific Northwest, where this recording is being made, the local community school students had to really rely only on the winter wren in the dead of winter, and that in early spring, the winter wren was joined by other species, but it was sometimes only winter wren calls that they heard during their secret spot time. We also notice out here that as the snow line rises and falls in the early spring, so do the varied thrushes. They seem to be attached to snow line. They seem to stay just below it. And so when the snow line comes down to lower elevations, that drives the varied thrushes to lower elevations. And they rise and fall with the snow line. So these are some of the observations we make in the early spring. We also notice in the early spring in the east that that's when the titmice really begin to start their songs. And you start to hear chickadees singing. And you'll hear some of the warblers that have overwintered with you, or the kinglets that have overwintered with you, they'll start practicing their songs as well at that time of year. But you won't see them being real territorial. They'll just be practicing their songs. When spring really arrives, you start to see a lot of flowers blooming around, and you start to notice the robins are really entrenched in singing, and there's a lot of male-to-male aggression going on at that time. You'll see lots and lots of territorial behavior at that time among a lot of different kinds of birds. And at that time of year, if you imitate a bird song effectively, like for instance, if you can whistle a titmouse's song, the titmouse will respond and fly at you and try to drive you from its territory, try to find the titmouse that you must be hiding somewhere in your mouth. They get really intense about it. And also at that time, you'll notice that the jays are starting to do something really interesting. And Donega Murdoch just reported spotting this for the first time. She noticed that the jays move around in these noisy bands, and they kind of circle around the forest, making all kinds of racket. And when they do that, they cause all the birds in the territories that have nests there to come out and act defensive. And that way, the jays are able to travel around the landscape using a form of jay sonar to find out where all the nests are. And what they do from that point on is stalk around and try to steal eggs and babies from the nests. And crows and ravens are doing the same thing at this time of year. So at that time of year, spring, is when you're going to hear the most intense nest defense calls. So also be aware that gray squirrels are nest robbers, as are red squirrels, and they'll occasionally steal an egg or a baby. And possums are doing the same thing, as are raccoons, and even sometimes during broad daylight. And snakes are doing that also. So during that time of year, spring, remember that there's a lot of nest robbing going on. And think about ducks and geese. I mean, the poor things, they'll have 10, 12 eggs, you know, all of which might hatch, and within a few weeks there's hardly any left, sometimes none, and they have to start all over again. So there is just an awful lot of egg and baby stealing going on at that time of year. Everybody seems to be involved in that. So pay close attention for that sort of behavior, and you will notice it. It's going on out there. I also like to stop and think about geese in this context. You know, if you have the opportunity to get around geese, you'll notice that whole 1, 2, 3 strikes you're out behavior really clearly illustrated in the Canada goose. As you walk towards them, they're all feeding in a grass field. the one that's watching you, there's always one watching, it's the sentinel, will raise its head real slow. And that kind of, that's the strike one thing that a bird like a junco will do in a split second. But a goose will do it over 2-3 seconds. It'll stretch that neck up real slow, and it's saying, hey, I see you. And if you keep walking towards it, it'll raise its head a little higher as it starts to walk a little bit. And that's to kind of say, hey, you know, I see you, and I'm taking evasive action. And that causes all the other geese around it to stop feeding, because in their peripheral vision, they recognize that signal. And then the third thing that the goose does is it starts to go, and that gets all the geese to stop feeding, and then they all look, and they all start walking and making that noise. So you've been given your two strikes, and if you push them any further, they'll start to sound that alarm, and once they do, everything in the world knows you're around. So remember ducks and geese for that. They can teach you a lot. At this point in the year, too, that late May time of year, you know, maybe mid to late May, that's when all the confusion of migrants happens. You know, and for a beginning person who's first studying this, the sudden influx of 10 or 12 warblers that are just passing through with all their songs will drive you crazy. Well, don't feel bad. You're not alone. It still gets me every year, too. There's birds that come in and sing only for a day or two near my secret spot, and then they move in, and they move on, and I never get to identify who they were. But don't sweat that. You're not alone out there. There is that feeling of confusion as all the migrants are passing through. At that time, you really do want to anchor yourself to your robin and your song sparrow and to the other birds that you know well. They'll help you to interpret what's going on around you. At this time of year, and a little bit later, you might also notice that jays are moving in either silent pairs, that is, male and female that have mated and have a territory, or they're moving around in roguish, noisy flocks. Those are juveniles, last year's and the year before's young, that are not nesting yet and who may never get the opportunity to nest, who hang out in these big juvenile flocks. And that's true of ravens and crows as well. Also remember at this time of year that the deer are starting to have their fawns. And during that time of year, in the area where fawns are hidden and known to be hidden, you're going to see a lot more activity of coyotes, a lot more activity of bobcats, as well as cougars and bears, if that's the kind of country you live in. Certain bears will absolutely specialize in fawn hunting at this time of year. So watch for that. During this time of year, and you're not going to get a lot of time to do this, this is an excellent time to map bird territories. So say beginning late April into early June, there's a real window of when you can learn to map bird territories. You'll really begin to understand territorial behavior if you spend some time at your secret spot during this time of year mapping out the bird's boundaries. You'll really begin to understand that certain birds not only tolerate other species in their territory, but actually like it. You'll notice that things like catbirds and cardinals and robins seem to be associated, but they don't tolerate other species in their territory. There seems to be some kind of group stuff going on there. You'll also notice this time of year, if you sit in silence and you get to that alpha brain state where you're really peaceful, that the thrush family has magical powers. In listening in a half sleep or a half daze with your eyes open in an owl vision kind of experience and really tuning into your senses, having done a Thanksgiving address, you might actually find yourself brought to tears by the beauty and magic of the wood thrush or the Swainson's thrush or the hermit thrush as it sings. So make sure you tune into the magic of the thrushes. At late spring, when a lot of fledglings are around, that's when you see the death of adolescence syndrome that I was talking about earlier. This is when the sharp-shinned hawks are really active. This is when you see a lot of harried parents. The birds are working overtime. They seem to have bloodshot eyes, and their feathers seem to be all stuck up and disheveled. They don't even have time to preen themselves because they're so busy feeding all these teens and watching them. I remember once seeing a chipping sparrow down in North Carolina act really funny and be chased by another chipping sparrow and how it made an alarm sound and kind of dove and hid in the rocks. And one of the other instructors, Mac, observed it, and he said, hey, that's an alarm. I said, no, that's not an alarm. That was a parent bird trying to get away from its juvenile. It's just so tired. It needs a break. And Mac's like, no way. So we stalked over into the rocks and spotted this chipping sparrow hiding in the shadows from its own young. And it was an adult chipping sparrow hiding from its begging young, which were just a little ways away. And this time, also, you know, robins are really busy and active. You'll see a lot of robins around, and starlings young are are all over the hedges. You know, they're sort of, instead of iridescent and shiny like the adults, they're in their juvenile plumage, which is brown and sort of dull looking. You'll notice a lot of begging house sparrows in every parking lot and every shopping mall in America. And that's when the crows are noisily begging. And this is when the weasels are busy feeding their young. And there's just a lot of stuff going on at this time of year. And at this time, it's interesting because they don't seem to care about territories anymore. At this point, the territorial imperative is temporarily disrupted. And the reason it's disrupted is because the parents are just too busy to care anymore about defending their territories. So you might think at that point that they're no longer territorial, but they're only suspending their territorial activity or their vigilance for a short time while their fledglings are getting ready to be on their own. Once the fledgling season passes, and even though they're done nesting, you'll notice that birds go back to being territorial. And I believe it's because once you've practiced territoriality to a great extent, your brain becomes patterned on it. That's why a neat person will always be neat wherever they go. Because it's not like neatness is always called for, but they tend to practice neatness everywhere because that becomes their sort of baseline behavior. And I think that's the same with birds. Once they've anchored themselves to a territory and know what that feels like, they'll be territorial even in the wintertime. And that's why alarms still work all year round. So when summer kicks in, you'll notice that even if you imitate a titmouse, it won't even come. It doesn't care, right? That's when territorial behavior seems to be almost tiring to them. You'll notice cowbirds gathering. You'll notice that birds are moving in larger and larger flocks as summer comes. You'll see groups of robins. You'll see groups of blackbirds. You'll notice if you're in rabbit country, rabbits are everywhere. You'll start to see things like a mother weasel traveling through the forest with its young, or a mother mink traveling with its young mink around it. This is when the foxes start to follow their parents out on the hunt, and when the bobcats are moving with their parents, and cougars are moving with their young. So it's a time when there's a lot of stuff going on. A lot of things are moving around, because it's harder and harder to feed the young, the predators have to travel farther and farther. So there's a lot more movement this time of year. So you might notice that. Sometimes this time of year, you'll notice raccoons out by day. And that's a new alarm that you may not have heard before, and you might not even expect it. But a raccoon will move by daylight, especially when it has young to feed and it can't keep up with it. Remember, the nights are shorter in the summertime, so that they have less darkness to hunt by. This is the time of year to pay attention for snake alarms. And this is also the time of year when the Canada geese lose their primary feathers, and when the young are just growing up. There's a time there in the life of Canada geese when nobody can fly at all, neither parent nor juveniles. And you'll notice a change in their behavior down by the water as they have to adopt a new strategy. During late summer, we notice that birds are beginning to disappear from the landscape. Birds that raise their young are moving on to new territories. They're getting ready. They're heading to the shore, or they're heading to their migration routes. You'll notice this time of year the buzz of insects, crickets and grasshoppers, as the fields and grass areas fill up with their sounds. You'll notice a new larder is kicking in. This is the time of year when the foxes start to eat crickets. This is the time of year also when you begin to feel sort of lazy and drowsy yourself. It's a time of year of resting and relaxing. It's a very, very quiet time of year. There isn't a lot going on bird language-wise, so don't think it's you if you're out there in the late summer and you don't really hear anything. That's just the way it is. This is summer. I remember late summer up in Alaska not too long ago when we were sitting at camp and we caught the scent of a wet dog as it approached us on the wind. And at the same time, I noticed that the ground squirrels were giving their alarms, as were some sparrows. And at that time, I realized that there was a grizzly bear upwind from us and its scent was drifting our way. But during that time of day, it was so quiet in the afternoon, there wasn't really much in the way of alarms. You had to really listen, because the alarm calls of the ground squirrels were so subtle. When we approach early autumn, this is when the grasses harvest. It's time for the grasses to be harvested, and a lot of the berries are ripening, the blackberries. This is when your flocks are really, really together in preparation for winter. at this time of year, you're going to want to concentrate now on your song sparrow. You're going to start to see the juncos returning. This is the time of year to concentrate on the cardinal and the winter wren, the jays and the crows, and the robins, who you have really paid attention to up until this point. You'll notice they've undergone a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde transformation. They no longer come to the ground. They start to hang more in the treetops, and they move in large groups instead of as individuals. At this time of year, you have to depend on your year-round alarmers, as well as welcome the winter alarmers who are about to show up. As the leaves fall, you'll notice the sparrows returning from the north. You'll notice that the birds that you depended on are all but gone. The first frost kind of is the end of that whole season, as you now have to prepare for the winter. And if you're in mast country, that is where there's a lot of acorns or hickory nuts falling, you're going to notice a whole new behavior that you have to pay attention to. Everything seems to gather around the oak trees this time of year. And at this time of year, the deer are going into the rut, so there's a whole other kind of thing going on as male deer are fighting and aggressively pursuing each other through the forest. You'll start to notice alarms around that behavior. Pay attention for the winter migrants' return. Welcome them back. Because then winter comes, and it's time to settle in and be prepared for the silence of winter, which turns out to be not so silent after all, when you really get to know the mixed flocks. At this time, people always ask me, well, what do I do with chickadees? They seem to be everywhere. Can I depend on them? Well, chickadees are dependable in that they will tell you when sharp-shinned hawks are coming, but they tend not to be all that tuned into what people are doing, and they're not really great about giving alarms. They seem more curious about people than anything. We have noticed this year, we learned from the community school, from Justin Chetler's observation of kinglets, that there is actually a kinglet call that announces the approach of people. So pay attention to kinglets. They have a CCC call that they give when they see people coming. They're good winter alarm birds. Winter wren, song sparrow, white-crowned sparrow, white-throated sparrow, depending on where you live. Look in your field guides to find out what birds are around in the wintertime, because now it's time to tune in to the winter sounds. But winter, there's an advantage to it. It's silent. You can see a long way, especially in the eastern forest now. Sound travels better in the cold, crisp air. And it's a good time to really kind of settle into a quiet routine through the wintertime at your secret spot. And it's the winter nights that are dominated by stars and owls, and I just love that time of year. So that'll take care of the birds through the year, things that you might tune into. And remember, you don't have to take it personally in the late afternoon summer when everything's quiet. That's not you. That's the landscape. Get to know the rhythms and feelings and changes through the times of year and through the times of day, and you'll have a more rewarding experience out there. So on the other side, we're going to talk about some other progressions, some other profiling tools, why beginners see nothing, and the progression over hours and the progression over days, months, and years. And we'll restate our goals a little bit at the end of this tape, and we'll prepare for the last segment here, which talks about the awareness implications of bird language training.